Welcome back to the Religions of the Ancient Mediterranean podcast. We're on the series on associations in the Greco-Roman world. Today we begin to introduce some of the tools we're going to use, some of the methods we're going to use, and some of the conceptual ideas that will help us to analyze the ways in which ethnic associations found a place for themselves or did not find a place for themselves within the culture of cities in the Roman Empire. So today we're mainly looking at the tools that a sociologist or an anthropologist would use to study identity and to study ethnic identity specifically. And this will provide a basis on which we can start to analyze ethnic associations in the cities of the Roman Empire. In the subsequent episodes, we first look at Syrians and Phoenicians as immigrant groups or ethnic associations in the Roman Empire. And then in the episodes after that, we turn to Judeans and then Jesus followers as minority cultural groups. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Once again, you can read more about this topic and get more evidence for what we're talking about in those books I've been mentioning in previous episodes. Let's introduce ethnic associations. So I'll introduce more of the social scientific approach to them, and then how we can approach ancient immigrant groups and ethnic groups within this context. And we're going to use the case study of Phoenicians and Syrians who move outside of Syria and Phoenicia elsewhere, form associations, and how do those groups relate to the societies where they are. This will help us also when we get to Judeans to ask the same question. These are immigrant groups in a new society. How do they relate to the society where they're in, and how do they relate to their homeland? Those two issues. And the gods and honors for the gods will play a role in both cases. And how did these groups adapt or not adapt to where they lived? So let me introduce a little bit about social scientific approaches to identity again, and ethnic identity specifically. First, I need to say a few words about identity generally and the theory of identity within sociology and anthropology with respect to associations generally and the study of groups generally. Then we can get into some of the more specific identity issues that relate to immigrant associations and ethnic groups, as we're going to be using them as an illustration of some of these issues today. So let's begin with talking about what identity is and some of the key issues around associations and identity. And anthropologists and sociologists have developed models and have developed theoretical concepts for analyzing how groups express who they are, to analyze identity. And there's the two components. There's the internal component in the way that sociologists talk about this, and also social psychologists. And there's the external component in identity. In other words, identity is a combination of what we as a group think of ourselves. Who are we? And that could be a variety of things that would be the answer to who are we, right? Could be ethnic related things, it could be places we live, it could be common honoring of a particular deity. There could be all kinds of components in that sort of internal self-definition of who are we as a group. So it's that internal self-definition of who we are that is part, and only part, of identity from a sociological viewpoint. The other component that's quite important, and we're going to get into it even more heavily in a couple weeks' time, is that the way that people outside our group view us, and our interaction with people outside our group, the external categorizations of us as a group, play a major role in how we redefine who we are. How a group thinks of themselves is not always the same over time because of that interaction with external categorizations. So external categorizations, in other words, outsiders viewing a group and having an attitude about it and expressing what they think about that group, influences how the group itself redefines itself. Now, within external categorizations or definitions, in other words, what outsiders think our group is, our stereotypes are part of that. So the analysis of ethnic stereotypes and stereotyping generally plays a role in that external categorization and plays a role in how a group within reacts to those categorizations and reformulates how it expresses who they are. It's a give and take process. So when a Roman emperor or a Roman governor talks about Judean groups or Judean synagogues as though they are associations, that's an external categorization, an instance of it. Happens to be that we saw already that the internal self-definition of some Judeans matches with it. In other words, some Judeans talk as though, yes, we're a theassos, or yes, we're a synodos. Yes, we're an association. But the main thing about what identity is, who are we? Because we're talking about groups here. So that communal sort of aspect is far more prevalent in the ancient context. So when we talk about identity, we're less focused on psychological things. We're less focused on my own personal identity in the way that we would study it if we're taking social psychology or psychology today. We're more focused on group as anthropological sort of questions of how a community expresses who they are, how a group expresses who they are. Identity is never static. It's formulated by the people who have the identity and reformulated and changed over time. The thing is, you can begin to have multiple identities where you are a Judean who's also an Ephesian, who's also belonging to a particular synagogue, not the other synagogue at Ephesus. You could also belong to multiple groups. I'm a Judean who also is a purple dyer. I belong to the Guild of Purple Dyers, and I belong to the Judean Synagogue. Anthropologists and sociologists are also interested in this whole aspect of identity. It's not only that identity changes, but you can have multiple identities. And when you're in different contexts, different aspects of who you are come out depending on where you are. That's even true for us today. So that inscription I gave out back in the day there was an example of a guy, Dionysius, on the island of Rhodes. We have a dossier of his inscriptions. So throughout his life, he had various interactions with different groups. And at some point late in his life, he said, "Do you know what I'd like to do? I want to get a copy of that monument over there and put it together with that monument over there, wherever they are," and got some mason to do a new inscription that got together all the different honorary inscriptions and minutes of meetings that he was involved in and put them all into one document. And what's interesting in there is that he's the member and leader at different points of at least three different associations. He's involved in four different associations for sure, each with different patron deities. But he is a long-term member, not just, oh, once I used to be, we're in the group that was devoted to Helios, the god of the sun, but now I'm in the association devoted to Pan. No, he was simultaneously in both. And he mentions the fact that he was a member and leader of these groups for more than a couple decades, two of the groups. And so looking at multiple identities is helpful when you're looking back at associations specifically. We even have evidence that Christians, Jesus followers, and Judeans that are out in the diaspora, out in these Greek cities of the Roman world, had multiple identities as well. Belonging to a Jesus group may have been exclusive for some of the leaders of the Jesus movement. Maybe some of the leaders wished you didn't belong to other groups, but we have clear evidence that followers of Jesus sometimes also go to the Judean synagogue. Here's an example. That you might go and participate in the Judean synagogue and go and participate in the group of Jesus followers. Not only that, but we have evidence that you may belong to the Jesus group, but you may also be a member of a guild. So that changes the way you look at the exclusivity or non-exclusivity of these minority cultural groups. It starts to broaden out the picture when you start to look at that side of things. Because the tendency in the past was to think of Christians as sectarian, that all early Christian groups were set apart from society, had very strong boundaries around their group, kept to themselves, didn't interact with outsiders, didn't interact with outside culture, cultural life in the places where they lived, were more ghettoized, so to speak. That used to be the standard way of talking about early Christianity. Even of Judeans, to some degree, that used to be standard. But what this sort of evidence of multiple identities and of participation in honoring the emperors and these other aspects of participation in cultural life, what these things begin to show is how complicated it is. That it's not clear-cut that all Christian groups or all Judean groups were totally cut off from surrounding society. They participated in different ways. They might have been participants in other groups simultaneously to being members in their Jesus group or in their Judean synagogue. So that's how multiple identities and identity questions starts to become part of the question of how do these groups fit or relate to surrounding society? Because once you realize that there's multiple identities, that tells you something about how members of the Jesus group interact with other groups within society. It starts to show you the boundaries between the group and outside and how permeable they were. The other thing I was going to talk about, and I'll talk about briefly, but not long, is there's sort of a common strand running through a lot of the evidence for various types of groups, including Jewish groups and Christian groups. And that is two models that influence how identity is expressed. One is the city as a model, the polis, as a structural model that influences how the identity of the group is expressed. The other is the family, those two structures of society. The family as a structure of society, or the household, and the city as a structure of society influence how identity is expressed within groups. And the thing I was going to go into in some length, but I'll be brief on it, is the illustration of how identity is expressed within a variety of associations in terms of being a family. Now, this was very widely known for a very long time with respect to Christian groups. Some Christian groups, they greeted one another as brother and sister. Now, what used to be emphasized is that the Christian groups were communities and that this was part of their communal belonging together, that they used that they thought of themselves as family. And the idea in the past was only Christian groups did that. No one else did. No one else had a community. No one else felt belonging in a familial sense to the group where they belonged. But the reason they had that scenario was they only studied Christian literature and didn't look at the Greek and Roman stuff, the scholars who thought like that. So what I did was I went and found all the evidence I could find in associations relating to familial language within these groups, because the common thing you see in social histories of early Christianity is the Christian groups used the model of the family, were sort of influenced by the household and expressed belonging together in terms of family, but the pagans didn't. So that's what you will see very frequently in Christian social history, even of the 70s and 80s and 90s. You still see it today. Now, how to assess the rhetoric and how it relates to social reality is another thing. But the rhetoric of family life, the rhetoric of belonging together as family within settings where you're not family. And so we have quite a few examples of this within associations. Moving on to ethnic groups and ethnic associations specifically now, we need to say more about identity with regard to these groups. The tendency now within the social sciences is to speak in terms of ethnic groups instead of races, and to not think of ethnic identity as primordial and static and based on blood. The people who belong to an ethnic group believe they are linked by blood. It doesn't have to be objectively true. Not only that, but there's no primordial identity. There's no set static identity of an ethnic group. Identity is created and reformulated by every type of group, including ethnic groups. Social scientists, the way they approach it, what distinguishes ethnic identity from identity generally is the emphasis on these three factors: geography, culture, and ancestry. A claim by the group that we share blood. We are from the same ancestry. Now, in many cases, when there's an ethnic group that has that notion, it isn't objectively true. But all that matters for an ethnic group to be defined as an ethnic group within sociology and anthropology is for the group to believe that. So those are the factors: the shared geography, shared culture, including language, including how you honor your gods, and a shared blood ancestry. Those three factors are what distinguish just group identity from ethnic group identity in the way that social scientists approach it. Ethnicity is not blood. Ethnicity is the perception of the participants that they are related by blood. It's perceptions of the participants in a group that define whether something is an ethnic group or not. And we're back to the thing we talked about earlier about self-definition, internal definitions of who we are as an ethnic group, which center around those three factors.
and external categorizations of who we are. And so ethnic identity is understood within that context of that dual process. And that the identity changes and reformulates and is re-expressed as time goes on. Another important tool for analyzing immigrant groups and ethnic groups in terms of how they fit within society is assimilation and dissimilation. Social scientists, I'm especially basing it on Milton Unger and John Barry, this whole explanation of assimilation and dissimilation. There's two types of assimilation. There's cultural assimilation, where two groups come into encounter one another, and each group has to deal with the ways in which their interaction with the practices of the other group influences them and changes how they think about things and what they do culturally and what behavior they engage in. And so this interaction between two groups that involves the culture, the language, the religious practices, the daily practices that are related to having been part of that group, the way those two groups encounter one another and how that impacts each group is what they mean by cultural assimilation. The degree to which one group starts to be impacted by the practices of another group and starts to reformulate its own cultural practices. So that's cultural assimilation. Another word for it is acculturation. So this can involve language, it can involve values, it can involve all kinds of cultural conventions and practices, and how these cultural conventions and practices and language are impacted by the meeting of two different cultural groups or ethnic groups. So that's the first component that's worth thinking about when you're looking at how an ethnic group relates to broader society and how the broader society relates to the ethnic group. The second one is structural assimilation that sociologists talk about. What they mean by this is the degree to which a particular ethnic group or a particular cultural group fit within the structures of the host society. We're assuming an immigrant group or an ethnic group in a foreign place, and to what degree does that ethnic group start to adopt ways to fit within the institutions? And by institutions, we mean things like political institutions. To what degree is this ethnic group participant or not participant in politics? To what degree are they participant in social institutions? And that would include things like belonging in an association, perhaps, right? Outside of your ethnic group. Economic structures, to what degree are they participants within the economic structures of society? So the whole thing in each of these is the degree to which an immigrant group or an ethnic group is participant in the host society or is interacting and adapting to the host society. So on the structural assimilation, that second component that these social scientists use, there's both the formal and the informal levels. So the formal level is more along the lines of the structures of society. To what degree do I, as a member of this ethnic group, have access to the courts? To what degree do I, as a member of this ethnic group, have ability to have a say in the democracy of the city of Ephesus? That's the more formal level. The informal level, what they mean by that is, to what degree as a member of this ethnic group, participate in local clubs and associations, more along the lines of what we're studying here, the associations. And so modern social scientists emphasize the importance of multiple memberships in groups where there aren't many of your own ethnic group in those groups. In other words, you're a member of an ethnic group, and yet you also go to different clubs that where they're not members of your ethnic group. So that's the informal social network sort of impact of assimilation, where the more you're hanging out with people that aren't part of your ethnic group, the more of this process of assimilation may take place in certain ways. And then that third component, very important, dissimilation and cultural maintenance. Namely, that social scientists who have a well-developed model emphasize that even though an ethnic group as a whole may begin to adapt and assimilate in a variety of ways to broader society or to the culture in which they're living, simultaneously they may emphasize and strengthen specific aspects of their way of life and specific cultural practices and language might be reasserted in a strong way to draw attention to difference even though there's adaptation and assimilation in other respects. Not only that, but at different points in the history of a particular ethnic group, certain things may be reasserted again that were formerly not considered as important, and therefore more adaptation was happening. And obviously that idea of cultural maintenance assumes it's possible for a group to be very heavily assimilated and yet still exist as a separate group. There's three main outcomes of this whole process of assimilation we've just been mentioning that have been often stated. One is assimilation. In other words, the loss of the separate identity of the ethnic group. The ethnic group disappears. That would be sort of the extreme end of the outcome of this process of assimilation. This is where the ethnic group identifies fully with the host society and therefore disappears. Marginality would be where the member of a ethnic group identifies neither with the host society that the group is in and no longer identifies with their own ethnic group. Marginality as an outcome of assimilation. Integration and biculturalism is, I would suggest to you, a far more common outcome of this process of assimilation, and I'm going to argue that the Phoenicians and Syrians illustrated it in the ancient context, and that the Judeans illustrated as well. Obviously different levels of integration, but integration means that you as a member of an ethnic group, or your ethnic group as a whole, strongly identify with your ethnic group, but you also identify with the host society. Let's put it in words that we're familiar with from what we've just been talking about multiple identities. You're both an Ephesian and a Judean. That would be integration and biculturalism. And in a way, this third one, at least for the evidence I've looked at for immigrant groups in the ancient context, this seems to be the most common way of sort of summarizing what's going on.